Now, behind The Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo, the story of life in Anawadi, a makeshift slum in the shadow of Mumbai's glittering international airport and shiny luxury hotels. Today, a squabble between two Muslim neighbours, the house-proud Zarunisa and the disabled seductress Fatima, ends in tragedy. The reader is Sudha Buchar.
At first, Fatima, known as One Leg, loved her poor older husband in the brother-sister way. She learned other ways of love after marriage. At 35, more or less, she had become known in Anawadi for a sexual need as blatant as her lipstick. Had she been another sort of woman, her affairs might have been a scandal. That she was disabled made them a joke. Sometimes the afternoon men left her money. Most were too poor to do so. But even the poorest of them helped her grasp what her parents had taken from her. Those ashamed and shaming parents who'd hidden an imperfect daughter in their hut. Zarunisa, her neighbour, blamed Fatima for drawing these men to the family doorstep. She'd managed to beat away one of Fatima's lovers, who kept drifting over to leer at her daughter, Kerkeshan, but she lacked the energy for a fight with her neighbour. June, the beginning of the four-month monsoon season, made every sensible Anawadian pensive. This year the clouds broke early, and for a week the rain came down like nails. Hut walls grew green and black with mould, the contents of the public toilets spewed out onto the maidan. Zarunisa had decided that she wanted a more hygienic home. She wanted a shelf on which to cook without rat intrusions, and a small window to vent the cooking smoke that caused the little ones to cough like their father. On the floor, she wanted ceramic tiles, like the ones advertised on the Beautiful Forever wall, tiles that could be scrubbed clean, instead of broken concrete that harboured filth in each striation. Zarunisa's children grasped the seriousness of the house renovation when their parents kept them home from school to drag everything in their hut onto the maidan. The rusty bed came out first, and Karam and Zarunisa settled in, guarding their possessions while watching Abdul direct his sibling labour crew. "Finally, my kitchen," Zarunisa said, leaning into her husband. No onlooker asked, "Why fix a house when the airport authority might demolish it?" Almost everyone here improved his hut when he was able, in pursuit not just of better hygiene and protection from the monsoon, but of protection from the airport authority. If the bulldozers came to flatten the slum, a decent hut was seen as a kind of insurance.
"You're all hammering too loud. I can't hear my radio," Fatima yelled through the wall. "We're breaking the floor, putting in a kitchen," Zarunisa called back. "So there will be some noise today." Abdul ignored the exchange, intent on his own problem. The only way to stabilize the cooking shelf would be to cut into the brick wall and cement the slab in place. So he began chipping away at the brick. 30 seconds later, Fatima began to shout, "What's happening to my wall?" "Don't take tension, Fatima," Zarunisa called back. "If anything happens, we'll repair it." "There is rubble in my rice," Fatima shouted. "My dinner is ruined." Zarunisa went outside. So did Fatima, and the two women started shoving each other. "If you don't stop breaking my house, I'll put you in a trap," shouted Fatima. "It's my wall to break down, prostitute," Zarunisa shouted back. "If we'd waited for you to build a wall, we'd all be seeing each other naked." Abdul ran outside and pushed the two women apart. 15 minutes later, a neighbour arrived to report that Fatima was in the police station, accusing Zarunisa of violent assault. When Zarunisa reached the station, Fatima was sitting at a desk telling her story. "This is the one who beat me, and you can see that I am a cripple," Fatima said.
"I did not beat her," Zarunisa protested. The officer put up her palms.
"Are you women mad, bothering us like this? We are protecting the airport. You go home and mind your children."
To Zarunisa, she said, "You, sit there." When Zarunisa recovered from her bout of sobbing, almost slumlord Asha was in the seat beside her. "For 1,000 rupees, Asha said, she'd convince Fatima to make no further trouble. Well, the money wouldn't be for Asha herself. She would put it, some of it, in Fatima's hand. We'll work it out with Fatima's husband, Zerunisa told Asha. Thank you, but it will be fine. By dusk, Zerunisa's daughter Kekashan was fuming. She could see through Fatima's open door, where she was swaying on crutches, to a cassette tape of Hindi film songs turned up loud. She had painted her face, a shining bindi on her forehead, black kajal around her eyes, red lipstick. "The police are keeping my mother because of the lies that you told, and you're dressing up and dancing like some film heroine?" cried Kekashan. A fresh fight began on the maidan. "Bitch! I can put you in the police station too," Fatima shouted. Suddenly, Zerunisa's husband, Karam, stormed into Fatima's doorway. "Half-wit," he shouted. "You lied and said that my wife beat you, so now I'm going to make you recall what a real beating feels like. Abdul," he called to his son, "come and beat her." Abdul froze. Though he had obeyed his father all his life, he wasn't about to hit a disabled woman. Fortunately, his older sister intervened. "Father, calm down," she ordered. "Mother will handle this when she gets home." At this hour, cooking fires were being lit all over Annawadi, the spumes converging to form a great smoke column over the slum. And now came one more fire in Fatima's hut. A film song was overwhelmed by a whoosh, a small boom, and an 8-year-old screaming, "My mother! On fire!" Kekashan shrieked. The brothel keeper was the first to cross the maidan, 3 boys fast behind. They found Fatima thrashing on the floor, smoke pouring off her skin. "Save me!" she shouted. The brothel keeper grabbed a blanket and smothered the flame. "She's okay now. Alive. No problem. She's a fool. She wanted to burn herself a little, create a drama, and instead she's burned herself a lot." "It is because of these people that I have done this," Fatima cried out. Everyone knew which people she meant. "A police case now, they're finished," a neighbor said. On arrival at hospital, Fatima said that Karam, Abdul and Kekashan had set her on fire. The account propelled officers into Annawadi after midnight to arrest Karam, as Abdul hid. But by next morning, the police had learned that Fatima's statement was untrue. If a charge against Zerunisa's family was going to stick, and money from the family extracted, a more plausible victim statement was required. In order to help Fatima make such a statement, the police dispatched a government official to the hospital. She helped Fatima construct a new account of the events that led to her burning. In the new account, Fatima accurately reported Karam's threat, but claimed that his son Abdul had throttled and beaten her. "How could you bring down a family you envied if you failed to name the boy in that family who did most of the work?" By Fatima's 3rd day at the public hospital, the blackened skin on her face had puckered, turning her almond-shaped eyes into rounds. She wasn't hungry, which was fortunate. Food wasn't one of the amenities at the hospital, nor was medicine. "Out of stock today," was the nurse's official explanation. What patients needed, families had to buy and bring in. The first time the officer brought down the leather strap, Abdul screamed before it landed, a howl that had built in him since early morning, when he had raced to the police station to surrender.
"She's going to die, and it'll be a 302, an officer told Abdul.
A 302 in the Indian Penal Code was murder. "I'd rather be beaten than see them beat you," Abdul said to his father, who said the same back to him, later when they were handcuffed together on the floor at night. As they lay on the tiles, Karam attempted to convince his son that the police didn't really believe they'd try to murder Fatima, given the hundreds of witnesses. Their concern, he told his son, was the money that might be made off the tragedy.
"So you've made big bucks here at Annawadi," one officer kept saying to Karam.
The idea was to get terrified prisoners to pay everything they had and everything they could secure from a moneylender to stop a false criminal charge from being recorded. The Indian criminal justice system was a market like garbage, Abdul now understood. Innocence and guilt could be bought and sold like a kilo of polyurethane bags. Every day, a haggard Zerunisa appeared at the cell window to explain the compounding price of their freedom. Asha was saying it would cost 50,000 rupees to make the police case go away. The officer who took Fatima's statement in the hospital also wanted money.
"What do you want, good statements or bad statements? I'm working for the government, so what I say will decide the matter,"
Zerunisa told her husband.
"I've already told Fatima's husband that I'll get her into a private hospital. Pay for everything, bed, medicine, food. What if this witness statement woman steals the money from the husband and Fatima stays there at the public hospital?"
If Fatima died, Zerunisa's husband, son and daughter would face a decade or more in prison. At sundown, 4 days after the burning, a Muslim fakir came to Annawadi with a peacock feather broom to offer blessings and drive away evil spirits. Zerunisa's daughter Kerkashan jumped up when she saw the old man. Taking a 10-rupee note from her bra, she closed her eyes as the fakir touched the top of her head with the broom. As night dropped over the slum, dinners were being scrabbled together, abuses being hurled. The next morning, Fatima came home in a white metal box. An infection had killed her. A doctor adjusted the record in the name of hospital deniability. Burns that covered 35% of Fatima's body upon admission to the hospital became 95% at her death. A certain fatality, an unsalvageable case. The slum grew quiet, and quieter still, when Zerunisa and Kerkashan emerged from their hut, heads covered, to wash the corpse. Only other Muslim women could perform this crucial ritual, the washing away of Fatima's sins. When Fatima was clean and sinless, Kerkashan closed the box and covered the bier with the family's best cotton quilt. Now a charge would be filed, likely based on Fatima's second statement, that a violent attack by her neighbour's family, particularly Abdul, had driven her to self-immolation. At the police station, an officer had told Zerunisa she'd have to pay another 5,000 rupees to see the charge sheet. Zerunisa returned to her hut and sobbed. She didn't cry for the fate of her husband, son and daughter, or for the great web of corruption she was now forced to navigate. She cried for the manageable thing, the loss of that beautiful quilt, a parting gift to a woman who had used her own body as a weapon against her neighbours.
And tomorrow, slumlord Asha forges her way into the Overcity as Suda Buchar reads the next instalment of Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Justine Willett.
Classic comedy on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Tom, how much longer are you going to be in the bars?
Come along, Bill. Just got to escort the toilet soap back to port.
Well, hurry up. I'm coming in. Now, listen, Tub, I...
Oh, Tub, what are you laughing at?
And I thought Moby Dick was just a legend. Come on, out of the bath.
Half a minute. Mustn't let that German submarine get away.
What German submarine?
A scrubbing brush, stupid. Oh, good. Hooray. Three cheers, Mr. Say. Good show. Here comes the aircraft carrier. HMS Soap Dish. Out of stern, we'll go and meet her. Whoop, 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 whoop.
Watch out. Rocks dead ahead. Big, great, black, craggy rocks.
You kindly leave my knees out of naval maneuver. Hello, action stations. Tiggling again. Submarine sighted. Wolf pack. 10 periscopes just broken surface.
Are your toes?
I know.
And what are you worried about?
I'm not facing that way.
Yeah, that's a point. Why are you sitting at the wrong end of the bath?
I've lost the plug.
Classic comedy on BBC Radio 4 Extra. Weekdays at midday and at 7 p.m. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock now. What next for Magdalene and Nora? Wilkie Collins' No Name continues in a moment. In an hour, Mel Gedroidge will be getting in a spin with the history of the hula hoop and asking why clowns give some of us the willies. That's in the 4 o'clock show. Later tonight, John Bird looks at the history of one of the world's most influential comedy clubs, the Second City in Chicago. That's at 8:30. So now it's part two of No Name by Wilkie Collins. It's July 1846. Magdalene and Nora have found themselves orphaned and left with no name and no inheritance. And they're about to find out just how judgmental Victorian society can be.